are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast this week is Rohan Shah, co-founder and managing director at Reuben Sinclair, a London-based recruitment agency with global coverage. Good morning, Rohan. Wonderful to meet you again after a couple of weeks.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it, Sina.
So let's start with a quick introduction to who you are and what you do.
Sure. Okay. So I'm Rohan. I'm responsible, along with my business partner, for the overall growth and direction of Reuben Sinclair, which is your traditional recruitment consultancy, but also RS Engage, which is very much a HR and talent management consultancy. On the recruitment agency side, we have a vision to introduce exceptional PR, marketing, sales, and digital professionals to businesses around the world, whilst also changing that sort of traditional recruitment practice. And on the RS Engage side, we have specialist HR consultants that go out and advise small to medium enterprises on their HR practices, but also put in place specific practical work for them, but also help a number of global clients transform their talent acquisition and sort of retention strategies with a particular focus on inclusive and accessible recruitment.
That's interesting. So how did you get into recruitment? How does one get into recruitment?
It's the same as many in recruitment. I simply fell into it, to be totally frank. Well, at university, I studied accounting and finance. That was more to please my parents than myself. And, you know, I think I was in year two of my degree, and after quite an honest and probably upsetting discussion with my parents, I took the decision to drop out. I just simply wasn't enjoying accounting and finance, despite the fact, actually, I do quite a bit of it now for my own business. I actually quite enjoy it. But, you know, my dream at the time was to pursue a passion in performing arts. I loved sort of the theatrical elements. I loved sort of dancing. Singing, not so much. I wasn't very good at that. But, yeah, at the time, that's what I wanted to do. I looked at various drama schools and, you know, I needed some money to pay for that. And I was speaking to a friend down at my tennis club at the time, and he was in recruitment. And he said to me, look, well, why don't you come and do recruitment for 6 months, earn a bit of money, and then go to drama school?
Yeah.
So I thought, yeah, why not? But once I get into something, you know, I want to give everything that I've got. You know, there's no point in doing it half-heartedly. So I went into recruitment. I gave it everything I had. Maybe I found that sometimes I was acting on the phone, and I just thought, do you know what? I'm actually quite enjoying this. I think the money was an attraction as well at that point in time. I was quite young, and I didn't have a lot of it at the time. And when I started earning, I just thought, well, this is great. And that's it. Here I am, nearly 20 years later.
I know, well-laid plans of mice and men. Yeah, but I'm disappointed to hear that you didn't pursue the performing arts. It's something probably you should give a thought to. So I'd say, like, as an Indian parent, I think I feel that I've been very liberal, but I didn't actively encourage my kids to pursue the arts, and especially my oldest kid. But she's in marketing. She passed out of Cambridge and is doing extremely well. But she took up improv a couple of years back. And she's so much. And I'm just saying it because you spoke about performing arts. I think it's something you should give it a try.
It's interesting, actually. I did a comedy course not too long ago, probably about a couple of years ago, which was so interesting. I was at a speaking event and I spoke to the keynote speaker afterwards. I said, what was the one thing you did to sort of enhance your public speaking? Yeah. And he said, look, best advice I'd give you is go on a comedy course. I thought, oh, you know what? This might be quite fun. It was the hardest thing I've done in a long time. Yeah, I had to get up and do a 5-minute comedy set at the end of it, which was great fun, but really tough. I think at the time, I also used to love doing magic. Like, magic was a real passion.
Oh, wow.
And actually, when I got the job, I just got entry as an associate member of the Magic Circle. And I had to go to lectures every Monday, which were in Euston. And if I even dreamt about leaving my desk at 6:30 p.m. to try and get to Euston, the company would just look at me and think, where are you going? What time do you call this? So it became really hard for me to go to lectures. And in a way, what you say about pursuing the passion, that was one of the things. I think my old recruitment company simply took away something I was really passionate about because I just couldn't keep up with it. Yeah. And when we started moving Sinclair, one of the things that we did say was, we'll never really steal anyone's passion. If someone has a passion, let them commit to it, go to it. Don't worry about finishing work at a certain time. Go out and pursue it, because, yeah, that's one thing I do regret, that I never kept up with magic as much as I would have wanted to.
Oh, but that's amazing that you're enabling other people within the organization to do that, because I think people are still worried when they come into workplaces or are working remotely, whether they can log off to do something else. So that's really nice.
Yeah, we actively push, you know, people's passion and how they keep up with it.
Since the time, it's been 20 years, especially in the last 3 years, how has the recruitment space changed or evolved?
Yeah, do you know what? That's a really good question. I think in some ways it has, but actually in some ways, no. I think surprisingly, the things that are still quite the same is generally the external process in the way people still recruit. So, you know, people still write a job advert, they review a CV, they'll arrange an interview, they'll do a first interview, maybe a second, maybe a third, and then they offer a role. And I think if you think about that process, it's certainly well documented that Leonardo da Vinci was the first person, I think, to write a resume in like 1480s. And not much has changed since then. So, of course, there's different ways now. Obviously, there's the digital element. People might be doing some video CVs online and so forth. But, you know, there's things that are going back 500 odd years and they're still exactly the same, which is really surprising to me. But in terms of recruitment and what we actually do internally, what has changed is the technology and the attraction and the searching for candidates, as well as the way in which we develop new clients and new business. But ultimately, though, it's still very much based on the same principles. I think it's a lot more data-driven now than it was, you know, 15 years ago. And obviously, a lot more is more automated rather than having to go through Rolodex or faxing over certain information and so forth. So I think where there's been a real shift in recruitment, specifically what we do, is what is probably known as the embedded model, which is very much what RS Engage actually does today. You know, this basically allows one of our specialist recruiters to sit on site and work for the client as their own in-house talent manager, utilizing the sort of expertise, the technologies, and all of the resources of a recruitment agency and within the agency that we have. So actually, you're getting a recruitment agency sitting on site working on your behalf as your own. I think that's really evolved in the way companies have recruited. I think this method actually works really well for businesses that, you know, that are looking to scale. And, you know, you don't have to be hiring a ridiculous amount of people every year. I think if you're hiring, say, 5 or 6 people per year, and that maybe includes churn, then actually utilizing this method, you'll see sort of a real considerable time and cost saving. But also, I think it goes beyond just finding people for a specific vacancy. You know, we then start to look at, like I mentioned, obviously data is really important. We start to look at the data behind the talent attraction, the numbers of how many people your business are attracting, the demographics of those people. What does your hiring process look like? Is it fair and is it inclusive? But that actually starts from the attraction stage. But then also the retention. If people are joining your organization but leaving, there's fundamentally something else that needs to be addressed. And I think all of this encompasses that sort of core principle of fair and inclusive recruitment. And I'd say that recruitment has really tried to develop itself and evolve itself in making sure that recruitment practices are fair. But I do think actually on this, generally in recruitment, it's a low barrier to entry. I think everyone knows that. And I think businesses today, there's a real responsibility for businesses to vet their recruiters properly, ask them the right questions, ask them the hard questions, challenge them on what they're using to find candidates and so forth. And I think you'll very quickly come to realize the ones who have the capabilities and the ones that don't.
So Rohan, would you say you're able to influence how they think or to broaden their thought process on the journey of recruitment? Because it's not just one thing. How difficult or easy it is to get clients to adopt some of the new things that you're suggesting, whether it is technology or whatever, in order to be more strategic, but also to be more inclusive in how they're recruiting their talent?
Yeah, okay, that's a great question, Sidhar. I think it's easy enough to have people acknowledge the importance of strategic and inclusive approach to recruitment, but it can seem very difficult to actually get people to actually genuinely adopt it. I think that's more so because when they realize the work, the time, but also the cost associated with it, you know, you can slowly see this barrier going up between sort of saying it's important and actually doing something about it. Now, I think we do influence how people think. some more so than others, but do they always get a specialist to help them implement an inclusive approach? I would say majority of the time, no. And actually, that's because I think recruitment or recruitment strategies or recruitment principles, however you might want to look at it, is viewed as something that is, it's quite straightforward. Now, I'm not saying that recruitment strategy or recruitment is rocket science by any stretch. It's certainly not. But I do think it's how people view, you know, maybe painting and decorating. I know I'm going to compare painting and decorating to recruitment. But most of the time, people will say they can do it themselves. And if they don't, it's generally because it's time associated. So it's easy to then just get someone else to do it. But when you get a specialist to do it, the difference is always so visible and, you know, it's so noticeable because it's a genuine skill set that's been adopted and practiced and perfected over time. My job is always to ask the right questions and to challenge in the right places. I can't force people, but I will always try to have them think about a strategic and inclusive recruitment process and the importance of doing it properly, because just like the painting and decorating, cracks will begin to appear very quickly and imperfections will stand out when the lights are on. So I think, do people understand the importance? Yes. Are they always adopting it on the whole? I don't think they are. And if they do adopt it, do they generally get a specialist in to help them? I don't think that's always the case.
Yeah, like you said, it's not rocket science, but it is one of the most important steps to building a great organization. And I don't think people are thinking that they need to spend money in it, because essentially when you talk about time, it also means money and resources, right?
Totally. Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, time is definitely money. I think generally when you've actually got someone's time, they probably are more likely to go on and spend the money. But like I say, I think generally when you've got the time, I think people are very eager to learn and to take a lot of information. And then when they've got some, but not all the information, because if you went into it into real detail, you'd be there for a whole week. Yeah. But when they've got enough information, I think it's that point at which they then start to go, well, actually, we could do some of this ourselves. And do you know what? They probably can, and they do. And some do it really well. But I think actually asking the right questions and challenging themselves in the right way isn't necessarily what they might be doing.
Yeah, that's true. So for organizations that want to do the right thing, what are the steps that they can take to reduce biases in shortlist, selection, interview processes, especially how can they use new technology?
But I think in terms of reducing biases, there are so many. I mean, you know, there are over sort of 13 different hiring biases that will happen in the recruitment process. And the way to go about this is to eliminate as many hiring biases as possible. You know, we are human beings. Things happen unconsciously. We need to put steps and technology in place to help us reduce layers of bias. First off, I think it's important to state that addressing bias in the hiring process is a consistently ongoing effort. It's got to be continuously looked at. But look, I think for me, there are so many ways of addressing hiring biases and eliminating layers. I think, you know, we've got a list as part of Iris Engage. I think there's around sort of 18, 19 different things that organizations can do on an ongoing basis. But I won't go through all of those. But to name a few, first and foremost, if you haven't started with training and educating your staff, that's really important. Provide sort of unconscious bias training, diversity and inclusion training to everyone involved in the hiring process, including the recruiters, hiring managers, interviewers. Make sure they understand the importance of a fair and inclusive practice. I think the second way is using structured interviews, implementing something that's very structured to the process with predefined questions and a clear evaluation criteria. This helps to standardize sort of the process and reduces the influence of personal biases that could go on. I think it's important to make people feel welcome in an interview, but reducing and not necessarily having a lot of small chat, you know, as I say, is important because that then starts to lead on to certain biases kicking in. But it's still important to keep a friendly process. You talked about technology. I think it's really important to leverage technology, particularly things like applicant tracking systems and AI-powered screening tools. Like, you know, I think these things can help in various different ways. You can anonymize resumes and applications. You can ensure that candidates are evaluated based on skill sets and competencies rather than sort of personal information, for example, which companies they've worked for or which universities studied at, you know. So technology can really help you leverage doing that element of anonymizing CVs. The other thing I think is that's important is diverse interview panels. So creating interview panels that include individuals from a variety of backgrounds, you know, having different perspectives can really help in making more objective and less biased-based sort of hiring decisions. And I think the other ones that are worth mentioning, feedback and transparency. I think it's really important that in the process, people are providing feedback to candidates on why they are not selected. I think this not only helps candidates obviously improve, but it demonstrates and forces sort of transparency in the process, but also it makes you really think about the evaluation criteria. So, you know, make sure that you're giving candidates good quality feedback and transparency. Something that I probably didn't mention right at the beginning was sort of inclusive job adverts. You've got to ensure that the job postings are appealing to a range of candidates. And I think in all job adverts, there must be a commitment for the organisation to highlight their diversity and inclusion strategies and what they are actually doing in this space. And then finally, I think there needs to be some executive commitment. All of this doesn't happen without ensuring that senior leadership is absolutely committed to the recruitment initiatives and the diversity and inclusion initiatives. And I think, you know, making sure that it's coming from the top just sets the tone for the entire organisation. And I think these are some of those sort of things on the list that I believe are really important to making sure that you're working towards a fair and inclusive process, but also looking to eliminating layers of unconscious bias.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just one thing, it's several things, and it's several things that you have to do consistently over a period of time to adapt to whatever the situation is in order to be more inclusive. So yes or no to blind CVs? I've had a lot of conversations about this recently.
Yeah, absolutely. So we did training actually around anonymizing CVs, and internally we used to say blind CVs as well. And we got corrected. And I think this is something because it's sort of some level of identity appropriation by saying blind CV. So actually, generally, I think going forward, the word we've always used now, the word anonymous CV rather than blind. But I think the answer to this one is really, like for me, is it straightforward? I don't think it's straightforward in the sense that the impact or effectiveness may vary. So, for example, the way in which an organization implements that process, you might get sort of different results. And so in that case, if they aren't implementing it correctly, it's probably going to have an impact on the individual that they're hiring and whether they're actually genuinely right for the role or not. However, if it is done correctly and sort of with the right advice, then yes, look, absolutely. I think there's enough studies that show anonymizing CVs helps increase the number of candidates from underrepresented backgrounds that actually make it past the shortlisting stage. Yeah. So a couple of examples that always stick out is the UK, the civil service, right? So after implementing anonymous recruitment, the UK civil service reported a 50% increase in the number of women and a 47% increase in the number of candidates from ethnic minority backgrounds who actually made it to the interview stage. Deloitte in the UK specifically, they reported a 30% increase in the number of female candidates reaching interview stage after implementing anonymous recruitment. And so I think, like, it absolutely makes a difference. I think it's got to be implemented correctly. And when done well, it can work really well. And I think you're giving underrepresented candidates a much fairer opportunity and a fairer chance because, you know, once they're in the interview process, of course, there's still so much to be done in that process to make sure it continues to be fair. But getting people into that interview stage can make a big difference. I think it's really hard to argue with the data that backs up the need for anonymizing CVs. But I think, you know, there are some studies out there that will show that if it's not done correctly, it can have an adverse impact. Like if it's not done very well, whilst you might get certain results that show positive, the actual end outcome might not be great for the organization. And you know, we need to remember that fair and inclusive recruitment is also about hiring the best person that is capable of doing the job. But it's about making sure that everyone has a fair opportunity to be able to showcase their skill sets and experience. So that's really important.
Yeah, that's true. So Roman, pay transparency, gender pay gap, ethnicity pay gap, how important are all of these to attract, hire, and retain diverse clients?
Again, it's a good question in the sense that I think for underrepresented talent, it's definitely important because, of course, they want to know they're being treated fairly. Like, who doesn't want to be treated fairly? Will a lack of pay transparency stop someone from accepting a job? At the moment, and generally from what we see, no, it won't. A lot of companies today aren't transparent with their pay and people are still joining them, you know, day in, day out. But is that likely to change in the future? I think it will. It's the moment that people find out that they're not being treated fairly is where issues arise. And so that can be a real issue for retention if you haven't got that right. I think at the attraction stage, you may lose out on attracting underrepresented talent because you don't advertise the pay. So that's maybe something that should always be done. Like, I don't think there should be any qualms or questions or queries about this. Advertise the salary on vacancies. But look, I think on the whole, of course, an organization who is transparent in these areas and ones that close any pay gaps immediately show commitment to fairness, equity, and inclusivity, which I think in turn, you know, naturally helps build a more diverse and inclusive workforce. But it's really imperative to stress the point that these areas mentioned should be part of a much broader strategy for diversity and inclusion, for a fair and inclusive process. And this encompasses aspects of other work environments, like the values, the policies that the company have implemented, the opportunities for career advancement. So I think pay transparency, pay gaps, reporting on that is really important, but it comes as part of a much bigger picture.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Any sort of pay gap at actually gender, ethnicity should be a part of a bigger strategy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if people think that just by paying fairly means that people are going to be treated fairly in other areas, like, it's not the case. And you know, you see people leaving, you know, we speak to people day in, day out that want to leave their roles. And when you hear about some of the reasons why, it is because I think some companies are quite performative in what they're saying. I think some people are taking action, but only in a few areas. And that isn't enough. I think actually, even if it's just small things across many different areas, this makes a big difference rather than doing just one thing in one area and neglecting the others, because people aren't affected just by one thing. It's a number of different things. So it's got to be part of a much bigger picture.
Absolutely. So moving on, there is a serious dearth of representation of Black and ethnic minority talent in the C-suite.
Yeah.
And, you know, at REEB, the PRC, Race and Ethnicity Equity Board, we've been talking about this quite a bit, and we want to sort of push the agenda on this forward. They talk about a broken rung and a pipeline issue in most places. Do you have any suggestions on innovative approaches to address the imbalance?
So look, obviously, I absolutely agree with you. There is an absolute dearth of representation of Black and ethnic minority talent in C-suite. But I think in terms of innovative approaches, so I think apart from what we've already talked about, there are so many different ways to address the imbalance, right? But are they innovative? I wouldn't say they're necessarily innovative. I think a lot of people know what needs to be done, but I don't think they need to be innovative. We just simply need to do what we already know and move away from how we've always recruited at various levels in the past. And I think that is fundamentally the hardest thing. For example, if particularly focusing on senior or C-suite, as that's what you've mentioned, if you're looking at C-suite or senior level, you want someone to come in who can have an immediate impact. You know, who the rest of the team will look up to, have respect for them, someone who will get buy-in because of their knowledge and possibly because of their track record. And normally, this means that they want someone from directly within the industry or something that is quite closely aligned. And at C-suite, in my opinion, and we recruited for a number of C-level roles, this is a pure leadership role. It's about setting the direction of an organization. It's about asking the right questions, not necessarily having the right answers. You know, the people around them that they employ will have the right answers. They need to ask the right questions to establish key industry and business challenges. And it's also about leading the organization, normally via a group of senior people, to achieve business objectives. So do they need to come from the industry to do those things? No, absolutely not. I think the industry is just so caught up on hiring its own from within because they believe these people will deliver quicker. And that might be the case, of course, but will they deliver better results in the longer term? Only time will tell. And I think that's exactly where it's hard. Organizations find it hard, you know, and in some cases, from a financial perspective, they can't look past probation periods. It's this time element. And so we resort to doing things that we've always done before because it always feels safer. You know, I'm talking about this industry. You know, a lot of it I talk about, a lot of the industries, the main industry I talk about is PR, but this isn't just PR. This happens across so many different industries. It happens in recruitment too, where you're always just fishing from the same pond. And guess what? If you're fishing the same pond, you're getting access to exactly the same talent. And we know, if we talk about the PR industry, we know that the industry is not close to being representative. So this isn't about being innovative. This is just about being bolder and moving away from the traditional selection criteria and search mechanisms, particularly at C-suite, where that tactical knowledge and the industry knowledge isn't necessarily the be-all and end-all of being competent in a leadership role.
Yeah, you don't need to know everyone in the media, right? You probably need to know how to run a business. And I'd say that from my own experience of what I faced in the UK is I think definitely the industry is looking to recruit people from the industry, but also people who look like them. And they need to move from there. And that requires, I think, a mindset change for people to do that, to have people who don't necessarily look like you to put your faith in them and let them run the business.
You're absolutely right. I think, you know, we say, you know, people like to hire an image of themselves. And I think unless they've got a fair and inclusive recruitment process, unless they've asked the right questions, unless they've got a criteria and a scoring process, you generally do gravitate towards hiring someone that is like you. Like, that's what happens. So that's why that fair and inclusive recruitment process is so important. But at C-suite, you can definitely look. We can look to other industries and you're going to find some amazing leaders that can run the organization in its entirety without having to be an expert in your field. So is that innovative? No, it's not. I think it's just about being bold and breaking away from the chains of what is the norm.
Absolutely. And like we spoke about post-pandemic world where people are working remote, flexible, hybrid, younger people, different to, I'd say definitely different to me or us. And I'd say that I think they know what they want and definitely know what they don't want to do. So it requires the ability to deal with them in a way to get the best productivity out of them. But as a recruiter, when your clients want somebody, some young person or some manager or somebody coming in at a certain level, how open are they actually to people who want flexible working or remote working or job sharing? I don't think job sharing is very common in our industry. In the public sector, it has been around for a long time, but not in our industry.
Yeah, you're absolutely right with job sharing. And you know what? Do we come across it often? No, we don't. Have we mentioned it to companies? Yes. But I think, again, it's about being bold and moving away from what is the norm. And I think companies, that's a really hard step. But I think there are some companies that are doing it. I think some companies really scream from the rooftops about doing it and how it really does work. I think the more we can learn from them, that's great. In terms of flexibility and remote working, I think employers definitely, I mean, they're a lot more open to it now. Obviously, since the pandemic, people have been forced into it being that way. But I still think from employer to employer, flexibility varies in its meaning. And I think this is the important part, is that to some organizations, it's the place from which you work. Oh, we're flexible, you can work from the home, or we're flexible, you can work from the office, or, you can work from anywhere you want. To others, it's flexi time. So actually, as an organization, we start a bit later, you can finish later, or we can start earlier and finish earlier, you know. Mm-hmm. Others might say, actually, it's when and how you work. And some might say it's all of those things. So actually, what does flexible working really mean? And I think Gartner did a survey in 2022, and they found that more than 80% of HR leaders say that they allow at least some employees the flexibility to work where and when they want, not how they want, but where and when they want. However, fewer than 10% of HR leaders say their organization offers any type of flexibility to all employees. And I think that's the key here, is that actually it's about entire flexibility, all employees. I think it's really important for candidates to clarify, particularly when candidates are looking for a role, they need to clarify the level of flexibility and exactly what policies organizations have in place to make sure it suits what they are looking for. Of course, businesses have to do what is right for their business. And it doesn't mean that every business have to offer XYZ every bit of flexibility going. They don't. Businesses need to do what is right for their business. So I think when businesses look at what's right for them, they can do that. And what one candidate wants might not work for one business. And that's okay. It's just about finding the right match for each other. Whether you're an employee or whether you're an employer, it's just about finding the right match. Just be really clear on what flexibility means to you and your organization. I think also one thing's for certain is that true flexibility, and when I say true flexibility, work how, when, and where you like, that will absolutely attract more candidates from every background. And you're going to start to open up a wider talent pool for sure. So that is definitely something to consider.
Yeah, and that's something I think that'll be good for people who are looking at not just the normal way of working.
Yeah, I think you can see now, like the whole working from home, you know, 2021, everyone was working from home. I think a few people coming back to the office. Now companies are demanding people are back in the office. Quite frequently. So it'll be interesting to see what 2024 holds. But, you know, one thing's for sure, I think people do miss being in the office, but it's not necessarily to get work done because they can do that from home. They could do that from a coffee shop. You can do it from the park if you wanted to. Actually, it is about utilizing your time in the office for the reasons people want to be there. And that is having this interaction. It is about collaboration. It is about creativity. So when people are in the office, if you're just getting people back to their desk and working, it's kind of like, is that serving the best purpose? You know, make sure you're making the most of when you are in the office. And I think there'll be better results.
Yeah. You know, this open plan offices, it is a bit counterintuitive for, I think, a lot of businesses, but people adopted it because it seemed to be the fad. Maybe it was just cheaper to do, you know, have everyone, you know, in that open plan where you can see everyone and monitor probably. I'd say that was a different time and definitely a time that has gone. You can definitely work from anywhere and use your office to actually probably get some mentor or to get some advice or just check on what's happening on the clients and sort of link up.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the way in which people use their time now in the office, I think is changing. It's not what it was. It certainly wasn't what it was in 2019. No. So for example, like we, you know, talk about open plan offices. We have an open plan office. We're only in one day a week, right? So, but what's very obvious is that people are now used to making phone calls in quiet. No one makes phone calls in the office anymore because it's just too loud. There's too much going on. So people are always generally stepping out. A lot of Zoom meetings or team meetings, people are actually stepping out and going into private meeting rooms to do that. Whereas before, all of these things were happening in the office. And again, I think it does put people off coming into the office. If you've got a day of calls lined up ahead of you, you're probably thinking, I don't want to go into the office where it's just too noisy. You know, I want to do these from home. So I think, yeah, flexibility has a variety of different meanings to various organizations. It's about working out what's right for you, whether you're an employer or an employee, and making sure that you're asking these questions at interview stage and finding what's right for you.
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, I've read about in the HBR and a lot of other research reports is that for organizations, you know, when you're talking about sustainability, development, innovation, etc., that in order to do all of these and even financial performance, organizations have to be able to win that war for talent.
Yeah.
So who are the organizations who are going to win the war for talent? How do they need to prepare in order to be able to win that war for talent? Because, you know, as you said, you know, there's a talent pool that is not so huge and people want the best people to come and work for them. How do you attract those people to come to your organization and make sure that you have people who would help you to deliver on what you're set up to do?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll come on to the McKinsey study in a moment, but a lot changed, as we've just talked about, from 2021. People reevaluated what they really want from a job and from life. And the key changes were, and they still are, that people, as we just talked about, want increased flexibility. They no longer wanted work to interfere with personal priorities. In fact, they wanted to be able to carry out personal priorities whilst working. And I think that's the secret to amazing flexibility. Second thing is people wanted meaningful work. No longer would a 5K salary be enough to just make somebody move. You know, they wanted some meaning behind the work that they were doing, a genuine purpose behind what they were doing and why they were actually doing that work. And of course, you know, particularly given the times that we're in at the moment with inflation and the cost of living rising, strong compensation is also very much at the forefront, right? I think also there's got to be a need for health and well-being at the forefront along with it, with the strong compensation. So taking these things into account, I think the best way for an organization to win the war for talent and diversify their talent pool is to do the following three things. One, they need to look long and hard at their EVP, which is their employee value proposition. That fundamentally answers the question, as a candidate, why should I work for your organization over anywhere else, right? this will attract the right personas for their organization. I'll talk about personas in a minute. That's a study that McKinsey did. The second thing was, I think companies need to really look at individualizing their benefit structure. For so long now, companies have what we call blanket benefits. So gym membership offered to everyone. Not everyone might want to use the gym. Someone else might want to use it in a different way. You know, so blanket benefits, I think, just loses its appeal. Remember that a benefit is merely a feature until it's actually being used. So it's really about making sure that every single person is utilizing and using the benefits that are offered to them. And that, for me, generally means individualizing them. And I think to attract the best talent and win the war for talent and diversify the talent pool, ensure a fair and inclusive recruitment process right the way from start, advertising through to finish. I said I'd talk about the McKinsey study. Are you okay for me to do that?
Please.
All right, fine. So basically, McKinsey did a study. I think it was around 2021. Where they surveyed around 13,000 people across sort of 16 different industries in various phases of job churn. So that might have been why people left their jobs, what would make them consider leaving, but also why would they stay or what would make them consider returning back. And what they found is that since the pandemic, there are now five new personas in the workplace. There's the traditionalists, right? So traditionalists are individuals who are motivated by job titles, good salary, career advancement. You know, they do look at work separate in the sense that their lives are probably, they will let work encroach on their personal lives in order to advance their career. And companies typically like traditionalist folk because it's just generally easier to attract through really common recruitment strategies. The problem is with traditionalists, the numbers of traditionalists are decreasing, they're waning, and actually they don't currently exist in high enough numbers. What they then found was that there was another persona called the do-it-yourselfers, people that value workplace flexibility, meaningful work, compensation as top motivators. These individuals were found to be between the ages sort of 25 to 45 years old and range from sort of self-employed to full-time employed in non-traditional roles, so like gig or part-time work. This group want flexibility above all else. Then third persona was caregivers and others. And this age group is typically between sort of 18 to 44. They're motivated by strong compensation, but they have other priorities in their life, such as to care for parents, might be to care for children, or even to care for themselves. And so these people value extensive flexibility, the support for health and well-being, and the opportunity to still advance and develop their career. The fourth one was the idealist. So this age group is younger, so 18 to 24. Many are students or part-time workers. They're generally free of dependents, mortgages, other responsibilities. And what they want is flexibility, career progression, development, meaningful work, and a community of reliable and supportive people around them. I don't think they want anything in abundance. They just want a bit of everything, hence the title idealist. And then finally, McKinsey had the fifth one, which they said were relaxers. Now, these individuals are sort of a mix of retirees, you know, and people not looking for work, or those that might consider going back to work, but they just don't have to. But they'll only go back under the absolute right conditions and circumstances. And generally what they found with these individuals want more meaningful work and flexibility. And I think as an organization, companies, when looking at their recruitment strategy, should be saying, well, what personas do we want to attract? Of course, if you can attract all of them, great. But I don't think that's necessarily realistic. But when you choose the personas that you are attracting or that you've got in your organization and looking to attract different demographics, you need to consider these things and what it is that they're looking for. And really what that then comes down to is evaluating your EVP and making sure that answer to the question, why should I work here over anywhere else, is specifically targeted at the individuals that you are looking to attract. Now, for me, your EVP should allow for what we call radical flexibility. It should allow for radical flexibility. It should allow not just the professional growth, but personal growth too. And I think there needs to be a holistic view of well-being in that not only are you providing employees with what they need, but you're helping them to understand what they need too. And then there's got to be a shared purpose. And this means sort of taking action rather than simply making statements. And then finally, for a good EVP, I think there needs to be deeper connections, not just with the employees, but with the employees' families and their communities too. And I think getting these fundamentals right will enhance any employer's EVP and not only help them attract the demographics or the personas that they're after, it will help them attract the best talent, and it will also absolutely help retain them too, as long as the company's following through with these things. And like I mentioned, companies that are moving away from blanket benefits and personalizing them wherever possible, they're the ones also attracting exceptional, diverse talent. Yeah. Sorry, that was a really long answer. But,
no, but it's not.
It's I hope it is informative.
Yeah, it has been very informative. So it's not a very simple thing that you can just say, okay, yeah, you know, we want to be there, have a great employer brand, and that's it. It requires a lot of work.
No, totally. Employer brand, again, is the big picture. Like EVP is a part of employer brand that sits within it. You know, the personas that you're looking to attract sits within the employer brand. So, you know, I think when companies think about an employer brand, I think they might think a couple of posts on Instagram will do, but, definitely goes beyond that. And there is a full-on strategy behind it.
Yeah. I mean, they should be willing to work and willing to invest, considering that the future of the organization depends upon it, right? Yeah. So we're on the last question, Rohan. We've been having a lot of fun, looks like. So what is the elephant in the room for you in your industry or our industry?
I knew this question was coming. So I think for me, the elephant in the room, I mean, obviously it's going to be something related to attraction and talent and recruitment. But I think the elephant in the room is that most CEOs, MDs, founders of organizations, particularly in service-led businesses, when they're asked, what's the most important thing in your business? Generally, most will say people are the most important assets. Yeah. And yet, when it comes to discussing recruitment strategies, it forming a part of board meetings, they have very little idea of what their actual attraction strategies and retention strategies are. And that's probably because they palm the responsibility off to other departments or to hiring managers to look after. And in addition, I think the elephant in the room for me is when most CEOs choose not to get involved in the recruitment process until the last stage or when they absolutely have to. And I don't think that this really shows that people are their most important asset, right the way from when they meet them at interview stage. Yeah. They should be there.
Agree. That's quite insightful, actually, Rohan, because most people in the services industry talk about, you know, people as their biggest asset, but then they're not involved in planning for that very important asset that is going to define the future of their business. So that's really, really insightful. Thank you so much for that. This has been a wonderful conversation, Rohan. I've really enjoyed the conversation. There's been lots of knowledge, and I think from your own experience, things that you have shared that I'm sure people will find very, very useful.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And yeah, really, really enjoyed the chat, Sidra, as always.
Brilliant.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcast. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.